to single combat, an action that always worked with the Heavenly Ones. This fused, however, waved for his companions to strike at Kaladin from all sides. Kaladin responded by lashing himself upward. As he darted into the sky, Syl automatically lengthened her shape into a long lance ideal for striking at ground objects from the air. Stormlight churned inside Kaladin, daring him to move, to act, to fight. But he needed to be careful. There were civilians in the area, including several very dear to him. "Let's see if we can draw them away," Kaladin said. He lashed himself downward at an angle, so he swooped backward toward the ground. Unfortunately, the fog kept Kaladin from going too far or too high, lest he lose sight of his enemies.
"Be careful," Syl said. "We don't know what kinds of powers this new fused might—"
The fog-shrouded figure in the near distance collapsed suddenly, and something shot out of the body, a small line of red-violet light like a spren. That line of light darted to Kaladin in the blink of an eye, then it expanded to reform the shape of the fused with a sound like stretching leather mixed with grinding stone. The fused appeared in the air right in front of Kaladin. Before Kaladin could react, the fused had grabbed him by the throat with one hand and by the front of the uniform with another. Syl yelped, fuzzing to mist. Her lance form was far too unwieldy for such a close-quarters fight. The weight of the enormous fused, with his stony carapace and thick muscles, dragged Kaladin out of the air and slammed him against the ground, flat on his back. The fused's constricting fingers cut off Kaladin's airflow, but with stormlight raging inside him, Kaladin didn't need to breathe. Still, he grabbed the fused's hands to pry them free. Stormfather, the creature was strong. Moving his fingers was like trying to bend steel. Shrugging off the initial panic of being yanked out of the air, Kaladin gathered his wits and summoned Syl as a dagger. He sliced the fused's right hand, then his left, leaving the fingers dead. Those would heal. The fused, like Radiance, used light to repair their wounds. But with the creature's fingers dead, Kaladin kicked free with a grunt. He lashed himself upward again, soaring into the air. Before he could catch his breath, however, a red-violet light streaked through the fog below, looping about itself and zipping up behind Kaladin. A vice-like arm grabbed him in an arm triangle from behind. A second later, a piercing pain stabbed Kaladin between the shoulders as the fused knifed him in the neck. Kaladin screamed and felt his limbs go numb as his spinal cord was severed. His stormlight rushed to heal the wound, but this fused was plainly experienced at fighting surgebinders because he continued to plunge the knife into Kaladin's neck time and time again, keeping him from recovering.
"Kaladin," Syl said, flitting about him. "Kaladin, what should I do?"
She formed into a shield in his hand, but his limp fingers dropped her, and she returned to her spren form. The fused's moves were expert, precise as he hung on from behind. He didn't seem to be able to fly when in humanoid shape, only as a ribbon of light. Kaladin felt hot breath on his cheek as the creature stabbed again and again. The part of Kaladin trained by his father considered the wound analytically. Severing of the spine, repeated infliction of full paralysis, a clever way of dealing with an enemy who could heal. Kaladin's stormlight would run out quickly at this rate. The soldier in Kaladin worked more by instinct than deliberate thought and noticed, despite spinning in the air, grappled by a terrible enemy, that he regained a single moment of mobility before each new stab. So, as the tingling feeling rushed through his body, Kaladin bent forward, then slammed his head back into that of the fused. A flash of pain and white light disrupted Kaladin's sight. He twisted as he felt the fused's grip slacken, then drop. The creature seized Kaladin by his coat, hanging on, a mere shadow to Kaladin's swimming vision. That was enough. Kaladin swept his hand at the thing's neck, still forming as a side sword. Cut through the gem heart, the head, or the neck with a blade, and, great powers notwithstanding, the fused would die. Kaladin's vision recovered enough to let him see a violet-red light burst from the chest of the fused. He left a body behind each time his soul, or whatever, became a ribbon of red light. Kaladin's blade sliced the body's head clean off, but the light had already escaped. Stormwinds! This thing seemed more spren than singer. The discarded body tumbled through the fog, and Kaladin followed it down, his wounds fully healing. He breathed in a second pouch of spheres as he landed beside the fallen corpse. Could he even kill this being? A shard blade could cut Spren, but that didn't kill them. They reformed eventually. Sweat poured down Kaladin's face, his heart thundering inside him. Though Stormlight urged him to move, he stilled himself and watched the fog, searching for signs of the fused. They'd gotten far enough from the city that he couldn't see anyone else. Just shadowed hills. Empty. Storms. That was close. As close to death as he'd come in a long, long while. Made all the more alarming by how quickly and unexpectedly the fused had taken him. There was a danger to feeling like he owned the winds and the sky, to knowing he could heal quickly. Kaladin turned around slowly, feeling the breeze on his skin. Carefully, he walked over to the lump that remained of the fused. The corpse, or whatever it was, looked dried out and fragile. The colors faded, like the shell of a snail long dead. The flesh had turned into some kind of stone, porous and light. Kaladin picked up the decapitated head and pressed his thumb into the face, which crumbled like ash. The rest of the body followed on its own a few moments later, then even the carapace disintegrated. A line of violet-red light came streaking in from the side. Kaladin immediately launched himself upward, narrowly avoiding the grasp of the fuse that formed from the light beneath him. The creature, however, immediately dropped the new body and shot upward after Kaladin as a light. This time, Kaladin dodged a little too slowly, and the creature, forming from the light, seized him by the leg. The fused heaved upward, using his powerful upper body strength to climb Kaladin's uniform. By the time the Silblade formed in Kaladin's hands, the fused had him in a powerful grip, legs wrapped around his torso, left hand grabbing Kaladin's sword hand and holding it out to the side while he shoved his right forearm into Kaladin's throat. That forced his head up, making it difficult to see the fused, let alone get leverage against him. He didn't need leverage, however. Grappling with a Windrunner was a dangerous prospect, for whatever Kaladin could touch, he could lash. He poured light into his enemy to lash the creature away. The light resisted, as it did when applied to fused, but Kaladin had enough to push through the resistance. Kaladin lashed himself in the other direction, and it soon felt like enormous hands were pulling the two of them apart. The fused grunted, then said something in his own language. Kaladin dropped the Sill Blade and focused on trying to push the enemy away. The fused was glowing with stormlight now. It rose off him like luminescent smoke. Finally, the enemy's grip slipped. Then he shot away from Kaladin like an arrow from a shard bow. A fraction of a second later, that relentless red-violet light darted from the chest and headed straight for Kaladin yet again. Kaladin narrowly avoided it, lashing himself downward as the fused formed and reached for him. After missing, the fused fell through the mists, vanishing. Again, Kaladin found himself low on stormlight, his heart racing. He breathed in his third of four pouches of spheres. They'd learned to start wearing those sewn into the inside of their uniforms. Fused knew to try to cut away a Radiant's sphere reserve.
Wow,
Syl said, hovering up beside Kaladin, naturally taking a position where she could watch behind him.
He's good, isn't he?
It's more than that, Kaladin said, scanning the featureless fog. He's attacking with a different strategy than most. I haven't done a lot of grappling. Wrestling wasn't often seen on the battlefield, at least not a disciplined one. Kaladin was practiced with formations and was growing more confident with swordplay, but it had been years since he'd trained on how to escape a headlock.
Where is he?
Syl asked.
I don't know, Kaladin said, but we don't have to beat him. We only need to stay out of his grasp long enough for the others to arrive.
It took a few minutes of watching before Syl cried out,
There!
She said, forming a ribbon of light pointing the way toward what she'd seen. Kaladin didn't wait for further explanation. He lashed himself away through the fog. The fused appeared, but grasped empty air as Kaladin dodged. The creature's body fell as the line of light ejected again, but Kaladin began an erratic zigzag pattern, evading the fused twice more. This creature used void light to form new bodies somehow. Each one looked identical, with hair as a kind of clothing. He wasn't being reborn each time. He was teleporting, but using the ribbon of light to transfer between locations. They'd met fused that could fly and others that had powers like lightweavers. Perhaps this was the variety whose powers mirrored in a way the traveling abilities of Elsecallers. After the creature materialized the third time, he again briefly gave up the chase.
He can teleport only 3 times before he needs to rest, Kaladin guessed. He attacked in a burst of 3 each time. So after that, his powers need to regenerate? Or, no, he probably needs to go somewhere and fetch more void light.
Indeed, a few minutes later, the red-violet light returned. Kaladin lashed himself directly away from the light, picking up speed. Air became a roar around him, and by the 5th lashing, he was fast enough that the red light couldn't keep up and dwindled behind.
Not quite so dangerous if you can't reach me, are you? Kaladin thought.
The fused evidently came to the same conclusion, the ribbon of light diving downward through the fog. Unfortunately, the fused probably knew Kaladin intended to return to Hearthstone. So, instead of continuing, Kaladin flew down as well. He came to rest on a hilltop overgrown with lumpish rock buds, their vines spilling out liberally in the humidity. The fused stood at the bottom of the hill, looking up.
Yes, that dark brown wrap he wore was hair, from the top of his head, wound long and tight around his body.
He broke a carapace spur off his arm, a sharp and jagged weapon, and pointed it toward Kaladin. He had probably used one of those as a dagger when attacking Kaladin's back. Both spur and hair seemed to imply he couldn't take objects with him when teleporting, so he couldn't keep void light spheres on his person, but had to retreat to refill. Syl formed as a spear.
I'm ready, Kaladin called. Come at me!
So you can run,
the fused called in a lethe, his voice rough like stones grinding together.
Watch for me from the corner of your eye, Windrunner. We'll meet again soon.
He became a ribbon of red light, leaving another crumbling corpse as he disappeared into the fog. Kaladin sat down and let out a long breath, stormlight puffing in front of him and mingling with the fog. That fog would burn away as the sun rose higher, but for now it still blanketed the land, making it feel eerie and forlorn, like he had accidentally stepped into a dream. Kaladin was hit with a sudden wave of exhaustion. The dull sense of stormlight running out mixed with the usual deflation after a battle. And something more. Something increasingly common these days. His spear vanished and Syl reappeared, standing in the air in front of him. She'd taken to wearing a stylish dress, ankle-length and sleek, instead of the filmy, girlish one. When he'd asked, she'd explained that Adolin had been advising her. Her long blue-white hair faded to mist, and she didn't wear a safe-hand sleeve. Why would she? She wasn't human, let alone Boren.
Well, she said, hands on hips, we showed him.
He almost killed me twice.
I didn't say what we showed him.
She turned around, keeping watch in case this was a trick.
You all right?
Yeah, Kaladin said.
You look tired.
You always say that.
Because you always look tired, dummy.
He climbed to his feet.
I'll be fine once I get moving.
We are not going to argue about this again. I'm fine.
Indeed, he felt better when he got up and drew in a little more stormlight. So what if the sleepless nights had returned? He'd survived on less sleep before. The slave Kaladin had been would have laughed himself silly to hear that this new Kaladin, light-eyed shard-bearer, a man who enjoyed luxurious housing and warm meals, was upset about a little lost sleep.
Come on, he said. If we were spotted on our way here.
If?
Because we were spotted, they'll send more than just one fused. Heavenly ones will come for me, and that means the mission is in jeopardy. Let's get back to the town.
She waited expectantly, her arms folded.
Fine, Kaladin said. You were right. And you should listen to me more.
And I should listen to you more.
And therefore, you should get more sleep.
Would that it were so easy, Kaladin said, rising into the air. Come on.
Vale was growing increasingly upset that nobody had kidnapped her. She strolled through the war camp market in full disguise, idling by shops. She'd spent more than a month wearing a fake face out here, making exactly the right comments to exactly the right people, and still no kidnapping. She hadn't even been mugged. What was the world coming to? I could punch us in the face, Radiant noted, if it would make you feel better. Levity? From Radiant? Vale smiled as she pretended to browse a fruit stand. If Radiant was cracking jokes, they really were getting desperate. Usually Radiant was as funny as... Usually Radiant is as light-hearted as a chasm fiend, Shallan offered, bleeding to the front of their personality. One with a particularly large emerald inside. Yes, that. Vale smiled at the warmth that came from Shallan, and even Radiant, who was coming to enjoy humor. This last year, the three of them had settled into a comfortable balance. They weren't as separate as they'd been, and swapped personas easily. Things seemed to be going so well. That made Vale worry, of course. Were they going too well? Never mind that, for now. She moved on from the fruit stand. She'd spent this month in the war camps, wearing the face of a woman named Chanasha, a low-born, light-eyed merchant who had found modest success hiring out her chul teams to caravans crossing the shattered plains. They'd bribed the real woman to lend her face to Vale, and she now resided in a secure location. Vale turned a corner and strolled down another street. The Sadius war camp was much as she remembered it from her days living in these camps, though it was somehow even rougher. The road needed a good scraping. Rock bud polyps caused nearby wagons to rattle and bump as they passed. Most of the stalls had a guard prominently stationed near the goods. This wasn't the sort of place where you trusted the local soldiers to police for you. She passed more than a few luck merches, selling glyph words or other charms against the dangerous times. Storm wardens trying to sell lists of coming storms and their dates. She ignored these and moved on to a specific shop, one that carried sturdy boots and hiking shoes. That was what sold well in the war camps these days. Many customers were travelers passing through. A quick survey of the other merchants would tell the same story. Rations that would keep for a long trip. Repair shops for wagons or carts. And, of course, anything that wasn't reputable enough to have a place at Urethiru. There were also numerous slave pens. Nearly as many as there were brothels. Once the bulk of the civilians moved to Urethiru, all 10 war camps quickly became a seedy stopover for caravans. At Radiant's prompting, Vale covertly checked over her shoulder for Adolin's soldiers. They were well out of sight. Good. She did spot Pattern watching from a wall nearby, ready to report to Adolin if needed. All was in place, and their intelligence indicated her kidnapping should happen today. Maybe she needed to prod a little more. The shoe merchant finally approached her, a stout fellow who had a beard striped with white. With that contrast, Shallan had an urge to draw him, so Vale stepped back and let Shallan emerge to take a memory of him for her collection. "Is there anything that interests you, Brightness?" he asked. Vale emerged again. "How quickly could you get 100 pairs of these?" she asked, tapping one of the shoes with a reed Chanasha always carried in her pocket.
100 pairs? The man asked, perking up. Not long, Brightness. 4 days, if my next shipment arrives on time.
Excellent, she said. I have a special contact with old Colin at his silly tower, and can unload a large number if you can get them to me. I'll need a bulk discount, of course.
Bulk? Discount?
the man said. She swiped her reed in the air.
Yes, naturally. If you want to use my contacts to sell to Urethiru, I'll need to have the very best deal.
He rubbed at that beard of his.
You're Chanasha Hasara, aren't you? I've heard of you. Good. You'll know I don't play games.
She leaned in and poked him in the chest with her reed.
I've got a way past old Colin's tariffs, if we move quickly. 4 days. Any way you can make it 3? Perhaps, he said. But I am a law-abiding man, Brightness. Why, it would be illegal to avoid tariffs.
Illegal only if we accept that Colin has authority to demand these tariffs. Last I checked, he wasn't our king. He can claim whatever he wants. But now that the storms have changed, the heralds are going to show up and put him in his place. Mark my words.
Nice work, Radiant thought. That was well handled.
Vale tapped the reed on the boots.
100 pairs. 3 days. I'll send a scribe to haggle details before the end of the day. Deal?
Deal.
Chanasha wasn't the smiling type, so Vale didn't favor this merchant with one. She tucked her reed into her sleeve and gave him a curt nod before continuing through the market.
You don't think it was too blatant? Vale asked. That last part about Dalinar not being king felt over the top.
Radiant wasn't certain. Subtlety wasn't her strong suit. But Shallan approved. They needed to push harder, or she'd never get kidnapped. Even lingering near a dark alleyway, one she knew her marks frequented, drew no attention. Stifling a sigh, Vale made her way to a wine house near the market. She'd been coming here for weeks now, and the owners knew her well. Intelligence said they, like the shoe merchant, belonged to the Sons of Honor, the group Vale was hunting. The serving girl brought Vale inside out of the cool weather to a small, out-of-the-way corner with its own table. Here she could drink in solitude and go over accounts. Accounts. Blah. She dug them out of her satchel and set them out on the table. The lengths they went to in the name of staying in character. They had to perfectly maintain the illusion, as the real Chanasha never let a day go by without reconciling her accounts. She seemed to find it relaxing. Fortunately, they had Shallan to handle this part. She had some practice with Sabariel's accounts. Vale relaxed, letting Shallan take over. And actually, this wasn't so bad. She did doodles along the sides of the margins as she worked, even if it wasn't quite in character. Vale acted like it was imperative that they keep absolutely in character at all times, but Shallan knew they needed to relax a little, now and then.
We could relax by visiting the gambling dens, Vale thought.
Part of the reason they had to be so diligent was because these war camps were a tempting playground for Vale. Gambling without concern for Vorin propriety? Bars that would serve whatever you wanted? No questions asked? The war camps were a wonderful little storm away from Dalinar Colin's perfect seat of honesty. Urethiru was too full of windrunners, men and women who would fall over themselves to make sure you didn't bruise your elbow on a misplaced table. This place, though, Vale could get to like this place. So, maybe it was better that they stayed strictly in character. Shallan tried to focus on the accounts. She could do these numbers. She'd first trained on accounting when doing her father's ledgers. That had begun before she.
It might be time, Vale whispered, to remember, once and for all, everything.
No, it was not. But Shallan retreated immediately. No, we can't think of that. Take control. Vale sat back in her seat as her wine arrived. Fine. She took a long drink and tried to pretend to be doing ledgers. Honestly, she couldn't feel anger at Shallan. She channeled it instead toward Ile's Sadius. That woman couldn't be content with running a little fiefdom here, making a profit off the caravans, and keeping to herself. Oh no, she had to plan storming treason. And so Vale tried to do ledgers and pretend she liked it. She took another long drink. A short time later, her brain started to feel fuzzy, and she almost drew in Stormlight to burn off the effect, but stopped. She hadn't ordered anything particularly intoxicating, so if she was getting lightheaded... She looked up, her eyes growing unfocused. They drugged the wine. Finally, she thought, before slumping over in her seat.
I don't understand how hard it can be, Syl was saying as she and Kaladin drew close to Hearthstone. You humans sleep literally every day. You've been practicing it all your lives.
You'd think that, wouldn't you? Kaladin said, landing with a light step right outside town.
Obviously I would, since I just said so, she replied, sitting on his shoulder, watching behind them.
Her words were lighthearted, but he sensed in her the same tension he felt, like the air itself was stretched and pulled tight. Watch for me from the corner of your eye, Windrunner. He felt a phantom pain from his neck where the fused had plunged his dagger into Kaladin's spine over and over.
Even babies sleep, Syl said. Only you could make something so simple into something extremely difficult.
Yeah, Kaladin asked. And can you do it?
Lie down, pretend to be dead for a while, get up? Easy. Oh, and since it's you, I'll add the mandatory last step. Complain.
Kaladin strode toward the town. Syl would expect a response, but he didn't feel like giving one. Not out of annoyance, but more a kind of general fatigue.
Kaladin? She asked.
He'd felt a disconnect these last months. These last years, it was as if life for everyone continued, but Kaladin was separate from them, incapable of interacting. Like he was a painting hanging in a hallway, watching life stream past.
Fine, Syl said. I'll do your part.
Her image fuzzed, and she became a perfect replica of Kaladin, sitting on his own shoulder.
Well, well, she said in a growling, low-pitched voice. Grumble, grumble. Get in line, men. Storming rain, ruining otherwise terrible weather. Also, I'm banning toes.
Toes?
People keep tripping, she continued. I can't have all you hurting yourselves. So, no toes from now on. Next week we'll try not having feet. Now, go off and get some food. Tomorrow we're going to get up before dawn to practice scowling at one another.
I'm not that bad, Kaladin said, but couldn't help smiling. Also, your Kaladin voice sounds more like Teft.
She transformed back and sat primly, clearly pleased with herself. And he had to admit he felt more upbeat.
Storms, he thought. Where would I be if I hadn't found her?
The answer was obvious. He'd be dead at the bottom of a chasm, having leaped into the darkness. As they approached Hearthstone, they found a scene of relative order. The refugees had been returned to a line, and the Warform singers who had come with the Fused waited near Kaladin's father and the new city lady, their weapons sheathed. Everyone seemed to understand that their next steps would depend greatly upon the results of Kaladin's duel. He strode up and seized the air in front of him, the Syl spear forming as a majestic silver weapon. The singers drew their weapons, mostly swords.
You can fight a Radiant all on your own if you'd like, Kaladin said. Alternatively, if you don't feel like dying today, you can gather the singers in this town and retreat a half hour's walk to the east. There's a storm shelter out that way for people from the outer farms. I'm sure Abiajan can lead you to it. Stay inside until sunset.
The six soldiers rushed him. Kaladin sighed, drawing in a few more spheres worth of his stormlight. The skirmish took about 30 seconds and left one of the singers dead with her eyes burned out, while the others retreated, their weapons shorn in half. Some would have seen bravery in this attack. For much of Alethi history, common soldiers had been encouraged to throw themselves at shard-bearers. Generals taught that the slightest chance of earning a shard was worth the incredible risk. That was stupid enough, but Kaladin wouldn't drop a shard when killed. He was radiant, and these soldiers knew it. From what he'd seen, the attitudes of the singer soldiers depended greatly upon the fused they served. The fact that these had thrown their lives away so wantonly did not speak highly of their master. Fortunately, the remaining five listened to Abiajan and the other Hearthstone singers who, with some effort, persuaded them that despite fighting bravely, they were now defeated. A short time later, they all went trudging out through the quickly vanishing fog. Kaladin checked the sky again. Should be close now, he thought as he walked over to the checkpoint where his mother waited, a patterned kerchief over her shoulder-length unbraided hair. She gave Kaladin a side hug, holding little Oriden, who reached out his hands for Kaladin to take him. You're getting tall, he said to the boy.
Kakadin,
the child said, then waved in the air, trying to catch Syl, who always chose to appear to Kaladin's family. She did her usual trick, changing into the shapes of various animals and pouncing around in the air for the child.
So, Kaladin's mother said, how is Lin? Does that always have to be your first question? Mother's prerogative, Hesina said. So? She broke up with him, Syl said, shaped as a tiny glowing axe hound.
The words seemed odd coming from its mouth.
Right after our last visit.
Oh, Kaladin,
his mother said, pulling him into another side hug.
How's he taking it?
He sulked for a good 2 weeks, Syl said, but I think he's mostly over it.
He's right here, Kaladin said.
And he doesn't ever answer questions about his personal life, Hesina said, forcing his poor mother to turn to other, more divine sources.
See, Syl said, now prancing around as a kremling, she knows how to treat me, with the dignity and respect I deserve.
Has he been disrespecting you again, Syl?
It's been at least a day since he mentioned how great I am.
It's demonstrably unfair that I have to deal with both of you at once, Kaladin said. Did that Hardassian general make it to town? Hesina gestured toward a nearby building nestled between two homes, one of the wooden sheds for farming equipment. It didn't appear terribly sturdy. Some of the boards had been warped and blown loose by a recent storm.
I hid them in there once the fighting started, Hesina explained.
Kaladin handed Oriden to her, then started toward the shed. Grab Laurel and gather the townspeople. Something big is coming today, and I don't want them to panic.
Explain what you mean by big, son.
You'll see, he said.
Are you going to talk to your father?
Kaladin hesitated, then glanced across the foggy field toward the refugees. Townspeople had started to drift out of their homes to see what all the ruckus was about. He couldn't spot his father. Where did he go?
To check whether that parshman you sliced is actually dead.
Of course he did, Kaladin said with a sigh. I'll deal with Liren later. Inside the shed, several very touchy Herdazians pulled daggers on him as he opened the door. In response, he sucked in a little stormlight, causing wisps of luminescent smoke to rise from his exposed skin.
By the three gods, whispered one of them, a tall fellow with a ponytail. It's true. You've returned.
The reaction disturbed Kaladin. This man, as a freedom fighter in Herdaz, should have seen Radiance before now. In a perfect world, Dalinar's coalition armies would have been supporting the Herdazian freedom effort for months now. Only everyone had given up on Herdaz. The little country had seemed close to collapse, and Dalinar's armies had been licking their wounds from the Battle of Thelen Field. Then reports had trickled in of a resistance in Herdaz fighting back.
Each report sounded like the Herdazians were nearly finished, and so resources were allocated to more winnable fronts. But each time Herdaz stood strong, relentlessly harrying the enemy. Odium's armies lost tens of thousands fighting in that small, strategically unimportant country. Though Herdaz had eventually fallen, the blood toll exacted on the enemy had been remarkably high. "Which of you is the Mink?" Kaladin asked, glowing stormlight puffing out of his mouth as he spoke. The tall fellow gestured to the rear of the shed, to where a shadowed figure, shrouded in his cloak, had settled against the wall. Kaladin couldn't make out his face beneath the hood. "I am honored to meet the legend himself," Kaladin said, stepping forward. "I've been told to extend you an official invitation to join the Coalition Army. We will do what we can for your country, but for now, Bright Lord Dalinar Kullin and Queen Yasna Kullin are both very eager to meet the man who held against the enemy for so long." The Mink didn't move. He remained seated, his head bowed. Finally, one of his men moved over and shook the man's shoulder. The cloak shifted and the body fell limp, exposing rolls of tarps assembled to appear like the figure of a person wearing the cloak. A dummy? What in the Stormfather's unknown name? The soldiers seemed equally surprised, though the tall one merely sighed and gave Kaladin a resigned look.
"He does this sometimes, Bright Lord."
"Does what? Turns into rags?"
"He sneaks away," the man explained. "He likes to see if he can do it without us noticing."
One of the other men cursed in Herdazian as he searched behind nearby barrels, eventually uncovering one of the loose boards. It opened into the shadowed alley between buildings.
"We'll find him in town somewhere, I'm sure," the man told Kaladin. "Give us a few minutes to hunt for him."
"One would think he'd avoid playing games," Kaladin said, considering the dangerous situation.
"You, don't know our Goncho, Bright Lord," the man said. "This is exactly how he treats dangerous situations."
"He is no like being caught," another said, shaking his head. "When in danger, he is to vanish."
"And abandon his men?" Kaladin asked, aghast.
"You don't survive like the Mink has without learning to wiggle out of situations others could never escape," the tall Herdazian said. "If we were in danger, he'd try to come back for us. If he couldn't, well, we're his guards. Any of us would give our lives so he could escape." "It's no like he needs us a lot," another said. "The gunless Riera herself couldn't catch him."
"Well, locate him if you can and pass along my message," Kaladin said. "We need to be out of this town quickly. I have reason to suspect a larger force of fused is on its way here." The Herdazians saluted him, though that wasn't necessary for a member of another country's military. People did odd things around Radiance.
"Well done," Syl said as he left the shed. "You barely scowled when they called you Bright Lord."
"I am what I am," Kaladin said, hiking out past his mother, who was now conferring with Laurel and Bright Lord Roshon. Kaladin spotted his father organizing some of Roshon's former soldiers who were trying to corral the refugees. Judging by the smaller line, a few seemed to have run off. Lirin spotted Kaladin approaching, and his lips tightened. The surgeon was a shorter man. Kaladin got his height from his mother. Lirin stepped away from the group and wiped the sweat from his face and balding head with a handkerchief, then took off his spectacles, polishing them quietly as Kaladin stepped up.
"Father," Kaladin said. "I had hoped," Lirin said softly, "that our message would inspire you to approach covertly."
"I tried," Kaladin said, "but the fused have set up posts all through the land watching the sky. The fog unexpectedly cleared up near one of those, and I was exposed. I'd hoped they hadn't seen me, but..." He shrugged. Lirin put his spectacles back on, and both men knew what he was thinking. Lirin had warned that if Kaladin kept visiting, he would bring death to Hearthstone. Today, it had come to the singer who had attacked him. Liren had covered the corpse with a shroud.
I'm a soldier, father, Kaladin said. I fight for these people. Any idiot with hands can hold a spear. I trained your hands for something better.
Kaladin stopped himself and took a long, deep breath. He heard a distinctive thumping sound in the distance.
Finally.
We can discuss this later, Kaladin said. Go pack up any supplies you want to take. Quickly. We need to leave.
Leave? Liren said. I've told you already. The townspeople need me. I'm not going to abandon them.
I know, Kaladin said, waving toward the sky.
What are you?
Liren trailed off as an enormous dark shadow emerged from the fog, a vehicle of incredible size flying slowly through the air. To either side, 2 dozen windrunners, glowing bright with stormlight, soared in formation. It wasn't a ship, so much as a gigantic floating platform. Osbren formed around Liren anyway, like rings of blue smoke. Well, the first time Kaladin had seen Navani make the platform float, he'd gaped too. It passed in front of the sun, casting Kaladin and his father into shade.
You've made it quite clear, Kaladin said, that you and mother won't abandon the people of Hearthstone, so I arranged to bring them with us.
3. The Fourth Bridge. The final step in capturing Spren is the most tricky, as you must remove the stormlight from the gemstone. The specific techniques employed by each Artifabrian guild are closely guarded secrets, entrusted only to their most senior members. The easiest method would be to use a larkin, a type of kremlin that feasts on stormlight. That would be wonderful and convenient if the creatures weren't now almost entirely extinct. The wars in Aemia were in part over these seemingly innocent little creatures. Lecture on Fabrial Mechanics, presented by Navani Colin to the Coalition of Monarchs, Urethiru, Yesavan, 1175. Navani Colin leaned out over the side of the flying platform and looked down hundreds of feet to the stones below. It said a lot about where she'd been living that she kept being surprised by how fertile Alethkar was. Rock buds clustered on every surface, except where they'd been cleared for living or farming. Entire fields of wild grasses waved green in the wind, bobbing with lifespren. Trees formed bulwarks against the storms, with interlocking branches as tight as a phalanx. Here, as opposed to the shattered plains or Urethiru, things grew. It was the home of her childhood, but now it felt almost alien.
I do wish you wouldn't crane like that, Brightness, said Velat.
The middle-aged scholar wore tight braids against the wind. She did try to mother everyone around her. Navani naturally leaned out farther. One would think that during more than 50 years of life, she would have found a way to rise above her natural impetuous streak. Instead, she'd rather alarmingly found her way to enough power to simply do as she chose. Below, her flying platform made a satisfyingly geometric shadow on the stones. Townspeople clustered together, gawking upward, as Kaladin and the other windrunners backed them off to provide room for the landing.
Bright Lord Dalinar, Velat said. Can you talk sense into her, please? She's going to drop right off, I swear it.
It's Navani's ship, Velat, Dalinar said from behind, his voice as steady as steel, as immutable as mathematics. She loved his voice. I think she'd have me thrown off if I tried to prevent her from enjoying this moment.
Can't she enjoy it from the center of the platform? Perhaps nicely tethered to the deck, with 2 ropes?
Navani grinned as the wind tugged at her loose hair. She held the rail with her free hand.
This area is clear of people now. Send the order, a steady descent to the ground. She'd started this design using old chasm-spanning bridges as a model. After all, this wasn't a warship, but a transport intended to move large groups of people. The end construction was little more than a large wooden rectangle, over 100 feet long, 60 feet wide, and around 40 feet thick to support 3 decks. They had built high walls and a roof on the rear portion of the upper deck. The front third was exposed to the air, with a railing around the sides. For most of the trip, Navani's engineers had maintained their command post in the sheltered portion. But with the need for delicate maneuvers today, they'd moved the tables out and bolted them to the deck, in the right front corner of the platform. Right front, she thought. Should we be using nautical terms instead? But this isn't the ocean. We're flying. Flying. It had worked. Not just in maneuvers and tests on the shattered planes, but on a real mission, flying hundreds of miles. Behind her, over a dozen ardent engineers tended the open-air command station. Ka, a scribe from one of the Windrunner squads, sent the order to Urethiro via Spanreed. When in motion, they couldn't write full instructions. Spanreeds had trouble with that, but they could send flashes of light that could be interpreted. In Urethiro, another group of engineers worked the complex mechanisms that kept this ship in the air. In fact, it used the very same technology that powered Spanreeds. When one of them moved, the other moved in concert with it. Well, halves of a gemstone could also be paired so that when one was lowered, the other half, no matter where it was, would rise into the air. Force was transferred. If the distant half was underneath something heavy, you'd have trouble lowering yours. Unfortunately, there was some additional decay. The farther apart the two halves were, the more resistance you felt in moving them. But if you could move a pen, why not a guard tower? Why not a carriage? Why not an entire ship? So it was that hundreds of men and chulls worked a system of pulleys connected to a wide lattice of gemstones at Urethiru. When they let their lattice down along the side of the plateau outside the tower, Navani's ship rose up into the sky. Another lattice, secured on the shattered planes and connected to chulls, could then be used to make the ship move forward or backward. The real advancement had come as they'd learned to use aluminum to isolate motion along a plane and even change the vectors of force. The end result was chulls that could pull for a while, then be turned around, the gemstones temporarily disjoined, to march back the other direction, as all the while the airship continued in a straight line. Alternating between those two lattices, one to control altitude and a second to control horizontal movement, let Navani's ship soar. Her ship. Her ship. She wished she could share it with Elokar. Though most people remembered her son only as the man who had struggled to replace Gavilar as king, she'd known him as the curious, inquisitive boy who had adored her drawings. He had always enjoyed heights. How he'd have loved the view from this deck. Work on this vessel had helped sustain her during the months following his death. Of course, it hadn't been her math that had finally made this ship a reality. They'd learned about the interactions between conjoined fabrials and aluminum from the Azish scientists. This wasn't the direct result of her engineering schematics either. The ship was a fair bit more mundane in appearance than her original fanciful designs. Navani merely guided people smarter than she was. So maybe she didn't deserve to grin like a child as she watched it work. She did anyway. Deciding upon a name had taken her months of deliberation.
In the end, however, she'd taken inspiration from the bridges that had inspired her. In specific, the one that had, so many months ago, rescued Dalinar and Adolin from certain death, something she hoped this vessel would do for many others in similarly dire situations. And so, the world's first air transport had been named the Fourth Bridge. With the permission of High Marshal Kaladin's old team, she'd embedded their old bridge in the center of the deck as a symbol. Navani stepped away from the ledge and walked to the command station. She heard Valat sigh in relief. The cartographer had tethered herself to the deck with a rope. Navani would have preferred to bring Isasic, but he was off on one of his mapping expeditions, this time to the eastern part of the Shattered Plains. Still, she had a full complement of scientists and engineers. White-bearded Falilar was reviewing schematics with Rushu, while a host of assistants and scribes ran this way and that, checking structural integrity or measuring stormlight levels in the gemstones. At this point, there wasn't a whole lot for Navani to do other than stand around and look important. She smiled, recalling Dalinar saying something similar about battlefield generals once the plan was in motion. The fourth bridge set down, and the front doors of the bottom level opened to accept passengers. A dozen edge dancers flowed out toward the town. Glowing with stormlight, they moved with a strange gait, alternately pushing off with one foot while sliding on the other. They could glide across wood or stone as if it were ice, and gracefully leaped over stones. The last edge dancer in the group, a lanky girl who seemed to have grown an entire foot in the last year, missed her jump, though, and tripped over a large rock the others had dodged. Navani covered a smile. Being radiant did not, unfortunately, make one immune to the awkwardness of puberty. The edge dancers would usher the townspeople onto the transport and heal those who were wounded or sick. Windrunners darted through the sky to watch for potential problems. Rather than bother the engineers or soldiers, Navani drifted over to Kamakal, the Thalen prince consort. Fenn's aging husband was a navy man, and Navani had thought he might enjoy joining them on the Fourth Bridge's first mission. He gave her a respectful bow, his eyebrows and long mustaches drooping alongside his face. "You must think us very disorganized, Admiral," Navani said to him in Thalen. "No captain's cabin, and barely a handful of bolted-down desks for a command station."
"She is an odd ship, to be sure," the elderly sailor replied, "but majestic in her own way. I was listening to your scholars talk, and they were guessing the ship made about 5 knots on average."
Navani nodded. This mission had begun as an extended endurance test. Indeed, Navani hadn't been on the voyage when it had begun. The Fourth Bridge had spent weeks flying out over the steam water ocean, taking refuge from storms in lakes and coastal coves. During that time, the ship's only crew had been her engineers and a handful of sailors. Then the request had come from Kaladin. Would they like to try a more rigorous stress test by stealing an entire town out of Alethkar, rescuing an infamous Herdazian general in the process? Dalinar had made the decision, and the Fourth Bridge had changed course toward Alethkar. Windrunners had delivered the command staff, Navani included, and Radiance to the vessel earlier today.
5 knots, Navani said. Not particularly fast, compared to your best ships.
Pardon, Brightness, he said, but this is essentially a giant barge, and for that, 5 knots is impressive, even ignoring the fact that it is flying.
He shook his head.
This ship is faster than an army marching at double time, yet it brings your troops in fresh
and provides its own mobile high ground for archery support.
Navani couldn't refrain from beaming with pride. There are still a lot of kinks to work out, she said. The fans on the rear barely increased speed. We're going to need something better. The manpower involved is enormous.
If you say so, he said.
The elderly man adopted a distant expression, turning and staring out toward the horizon. Admiral? Navani asked. Are you all right?
I'm simply imagining the end of an era. The livelihood I've known, the way of the oceans, and the navy.
We'll continue to need navies, Navani said. This air transport is merely an additional tool.
Perhaps, perhaps. But for a moment, imagine a fleet of ordinary ships suffering an attack from one of these up above. It wouldn't need trained archers. The flying sailors could drop stones and sink a fleet in minutes.
He glanced to her.
My dear, if these things become ubiquitous, it won't only be navies that are rendered obsolete. I can't decide if I'm glad to be old enough to wish my world a fond farewell, or if I envy the young lads who get to explore this new world.
Navani found herself at a loss for words. She wanted to offer encouragement, but the past that Kamakal regarded with such fondness was, well, like waves in water. Gone now, absorbed by the ocean of time. It was the future that excited her. Kamakal seemed to sense her hesitance as he smiled.
Don't mind the ramblings of a grouchy old sailor. Look, the bondsmith wishes your attention. Go and guide us toward a new horizon, Brightness. That is where we'll find success against these invaders.
She gave Kamakal a fond pat on the arm, then hastened off toward Dalinar. He stood near the front center of the deck, and High Marshal Kaladin was striding toward him, accompanied by a bespectacled man. This must be the Windrunner's father, though it took some imagination on her part to see the resemblance. Kaladin was tall, and Lirin was short. The younger man had that unruly hair, falling in a natural curl. Lirin, on the other hand, was balding, with the rest of his hair kept very short. However, as she stepped up beside Dalinar, she caught Lirin's eyes, and the familial connection became more obvious. That same quiet intensity, that same faintly judgmental gaze that seemed to know too much about you. In that moment, she saw two men with the same soul, for all their physical differences.
Sir, Kaladin said to Dalinar, my father, the surgeon.
Dalinar nodded his head.
Lirin Stormblessed, it is my honor.
Stormblessed? Lirin asked.
He didn't bow, which Navani found undiplomatic, considering whom he was meeting.
I assumed you would take your son's house name, Dalinar said.
Lirin glanced at his son, who evidently hadn't told him about his elevation, but he said nothing more, instead turning to give her heirship a proper nod of respect.
This is a magnificent creation, Lirin said. Do you think it could quickly deliver a mobile hospital, staffed with surgeons, to a battlefield? The lives that could be saved that way. An ingenious application,
Dalinar said.
Though edge dancers generally do that job now. Oh, right.
Lirin adjusted his spectacles, then finally seemed to find a little respect for Dalinar.
I appreciate what you're doing here, Bright Lord Colin. But can you say how long my people will be trapped on this vehicle? It will be a several-week flight to reach the Shattered Plains,
Dalinar said.
But we'll be delivering supplies, blankets, and other items of comfort during the trip. You'll be performing an important function, helping us learn how to better equip these transports. Plus, we'll be denying the enemy an important population center and farming community.
Lirin nodded, thoughtful.
Why don't you inspect the accommodations? Dalinar offered. The holds aren't luxurious, but there's space enough for hundreds.
Lirin accepted the dismissal, though he again didn't bow or offer respect as he strode away. Kaladin hung back.
I apologize for my father, sir. He doesn't deal well with surprises. It's all right, Dalinar said. I can only imagine what these people have been through lately.
It might not be over quite yet, sir. I was spotted while scouting earlier today. One of the fused, a variety I've never seen before, came to Hearthstone, hunting me. I ran him off, but I have no doubt we'll soon encounter more resistance.
Dalinar tried to remain stoic, but Navani could see his disappointment in the downturn of his lips.
Very well, he said. I'd hoped the fog might cover us, but that was plainly too convenient. Go alert the other windrunners, and I'll send word for the edge dancers to hasten the evacuation.
Kaladin nodded.
I'm running low on light, sir.
Navani slipped her notebook from her pocket as Dalinar raised his hand and pressed it against Kaladin's chest. There was a faint warping to the air around them, and for a moment she thought she could see into Shadesmar, another realm filled with beads of glass and candle flames floating in place of people's souls. She thought, for the briefest moment, she heard a tone in the distance, a pure note vibrating through her. It was gone in a moment, but she wrote her impressions anyway. Dalinar's powers were related to the composition of Stormlight, the three realms, and ultimately, the very nature of deity. There were secrets here to unlock. Kaladin's light was renewed, wisps of it steaming off his skin, visible even in daylight. The spheres he carried would be renewed as well. Somehow, Dalinar reached between realms to touch the Almighty's own power, an ability once reserved solely for storms and the things that lived in them. Appearing invigorated, the young windrunner stepped across the deck. He knelt and rested his hand on the rectangular patch of wood that stood out from the rest, not newly cut, but dinged and marked from arrows. His old bridge had been embedded to be flush with the rest of the deck. The bridge four windrunners all enacted this same wordless ritual when they left the airship. It took only a moment, then Kaladin launched into the air. Navani finished her notes, covering a smile as she found Dalinar reading over her shoulder. That was still a decidedly odd experience, for all that she tried to encourage him.
I've already let Yasna make notes on what I do, Dalinar said. Yet each time you pull out this notebook, what are you looking for, Gemheart?
I'm not sure yet, she said. Something is odd about the nature of Urethiru, and I think bondsmiths might be related to the tower, at least from what we read about the old radiance. She flipped to another page and showed him some schematics she'd drawn. The tower city of Urethiru had an enormous gemstone construction at its heart, a crystal pillar, a fabril unlike any she'd ever seen. She was increasingly certain the tower had once been powered by that pillar, as this flying ship was powered by the gemstones her engineers had embedded within the hull. But the tower was broken, barely functioning.
I tried infusing that pillar, Dalinar said. It didn't work.
He could infuse Stormlight into ordinary spheres, but those tower gemstones had resisted,
We must be approaching the problem in the wrong way. I can't help thinking if I knew more about Stormlight, the solution would be simple. She shook her head. The fourth bridge was an extraordinary accomplishment, but she worried she was failing in a greater task. Eurythiru was high in the mountains, where it was too cold to grow plants, yet the tower had numerous fields. People had not only survived up in that harsh environment, they had thrived. How? She knew the tower had once been occupied by a powerful Spren, named the Sibling, a Spren on the level of the Night Watcher or the Stormfather, and capable of making a bondsmith. She had to assume the Spren, or perhaps something about its relationship with a human, had allowed the tower to function. Unfortunately, the Sibling had died during the recreants. She wasn't certain what level of dead that meant. Was the Sibling dead like the souls of Shardblades that still walked around? Some Spren she interviewed said the Sibling was slumbering, but they treated that as final. The answers weren't clear, and that left Navani struggling to try to understand. She studied Dalinar and his bond with the Stormfather, hoping it would offer some further clue.
So, an accented voice said from behind them, the Alethi really have learned to fly. I should have believed the stories. Only your kind are stubborn enough to bully nature herself.
Navani started, though she was slower to respond than Dalinar, who spun, hand on his side sword, and immediately stepped between Navani and the strange voice. She had to peek around him to see the man who had spoken. He was a short fellow, missing a tooth, with a flat nose and a jovial expression. His worn cloak and ragged trousers marked him as a refugee. He stood next to Navani's engineer station, where he'd picked up the map that charted the fourth bridge's course. Velat, standing at the center of the desks, yelped when she saw him, then reached over to snatch the paper away. Refugees are to gather below decks, Navani said, pointing the way back to the steps.
Good for them, the Herdazian man said. Your flying boy says you've got a place for me here. Don't know what I think of serving an Alethi. I've spent most of my life trying to stay away from them.
He eyed Dalinar.
You specifically, Blackthorn. No offense.
Ah, Navani thought. She'd heard that the mink wasn't what people expected. She revised her assessment, then glanced toward the cobalt guardsmen who were belatedly rushing up from the sides of the ship. They appeared chagrined, but Navani waved them off. She'd ask some pointed questions later about why they'd been so lax as to let this man sneak up the steps to the command station.
I find wisdom in men who knew to avoid the person I once was,
Dalinar said to the mink.
But this is a new era, with new enemies. Our past squabbles are of no concern now.
Squabbles? The man asked. So that's the Alethi word for them. Yes, yes. My mastery of your language, you see, is lacking. I'd been mistakenly referring to your actions as raping and burning my people.
He pulled something from his pocket, another of Velat's maps. He glanced over his shoulder to check that she wasn't watching, then unrolled it and cocked his head, inspecting it.
What remains of my army is secluded in four separate hollows between here and Hedez, he said. I have only a few hundred left. Use your flying machine to rescue them, and we'll talk. Alethi bloodlust has cost me many loved ones over the years, but I'd be a fool not to admit the value in pointing it, like the proverbial sword's blade, at someone else.
It will be done, Dalinar said.
Navani didn't miss that, despite claiming earlier that the fourth bridge was her ship. He agreed to fly it per the mink's request, without so much as consulting her. She tried not to let things like that bother her. It wasn't that her husband didn't respect her. He'd proven on numerous occasions that he did.
Dalinar Kolin was simply accustomed to being the most important and generally most capable person around. That led a man to surge forward like an advancing storm wall, making decisions as the need arose. Still, it irked her more than she'd ever admit out loud. The first of the real refugees began to arrive down below, herded gently by the edge dancers. Navani focused on the problem at hand, making certain each person was settled and comfortable in the most economical and orderly way possible. She'd drawn up a plan. Unfortunately, the welcome was interrupted as Lynn, a windrunner woman with long dark hair worn in a braid, slammed down onto the deck.
"Incoming fused, sir," she reported to Dalinar. "Three full flights of them."
"Kaladin was right then," he said. "Hopefully we can drive them away. Storms help us if they decide to harry the ship all the way to the shattered plains."
That was Navani's worst fear, that flying enemies would be able to strike at and even disable the transport. She had precautions in place to try to prevent that, and it looked like she'd get to witness their initial test firsthand. 4. Architects of the Future. To draw stormlight out of a gemstone, I use the Arnest method. Several large empty gemstones are brought close to the infused one while the Spren is inspecting it. Stormlight is slowly absorbed from a small gemstone by a very large gemstone of the same type, and several together can draw the light out quickly. The method's limitation is, of course, the fact that you need not merely acquire one gemstone for your fabrial, but several larger ones to withdraw the stormlight. Other methods must exist, as proven by the extremely large gemstone fabrials created by the Vristal Guild out of Thalina. If Her Majesty would please repeat my request to the Guild, this secret is of vital importance to the war effort. Lecture on Fabrial Mechanics presented by Navani Kolin to the Coalition of Monarchs, Urethiru, Yesevan, 1175. When they awoke, Radiant immediately took charge and assessed the situation. She had a sack over her head, so nobody saw her disorientation, and she was careful not to move and warn her captors. Shallan had fortunately attached her light weaving in such a way that it would keep up their illusory phase, even while they were unconscious. Radiant didn't appear to be bound, though she was being carried over someone's shoulder. He smelled of chulls, or maybe it was the sack. Her body had activated her powers, healed her, and let her wake sooner than she would have otherwise. Radiant didn't like sneaking about or pretending, but she trusted that Vale and Shallan knew what they were doing. She instead did her part, judging the danger of the current situation. She seemed to be fine, though uncomfortable. Her head kept bouncing into the man's back, pressing the sack against her face with each step. Deep down, she felt satisfaction from Vale. They'd nearly given up on this mission. It was nice to know that all their work hadn't been in vain. Now, where were they taking her? That had proven one of the biggest mysteries, where the Sons of Honor held their little meetings. Shallan's team had managed to get one person into the group months ago, but he hadn't been important enough to be given the information they needed. A Light Eyes had been required. They suspected Iale had taken over the cult, now that Amaram was dead. Her faction was planning to seize the Oathgate at the center of the Shattered Plains. Unfortunately, Radiant didn't have proof of these facts, and she would not move against Iale without solid proof. Dalinar agreed with her, particularly after what Adolin had done to Iale's husband. "Too bad he didn't find a way to finish off the pair of them," Vale thought. That would not have been right, Radiant thought back. Iale was no threat to him then. Shallan didn't agree, and naturally Vale didn't either, so Radiant let the matter drop. Hopefully, Pattern was still following at a distance as instructed. Once the group stopped and began initiating Radiant, the Spren would fetch Adolin and the soldiers in case she needed extraction. Eventually, her captors halted, and rough hands hauled her off the shoulder. She closed her eyes and forced herself to remain limp as they set her on the ground. Wet and slimy rock, someplace cool. The sack came off, and she smelled something pungent. When she didn't stir fast enough, someone dumped water on her head. It was time for Vale to take over. She gasped awake, shoving aside her first instinct, which was to grab a knife and make short work of whoever had drenched her. Vale wiped her eyes with her safe hand sleeve and found herself someplace dank and humid. Plants on the stone walls had pulled in at the ruckus, and the sky was a distant crack high in the air. Lifespren bobbed around many thick plants and vines. She was in one of the chasms. Kellek's breath. How had they carried her down into the chasms without anyone seeing? A group of people in black robes stood around her, each holding a brightly shining diamond brome in one palm. She blinked at the sharp light. Their hoods looked a fair bit more comfortable than her sack. Each robe was embroidered with the double eye of the Almighty, and Shallan had a fleeting thought, wondering at the seamstress they'd hired to do all this work. What had they told her? Yes, we want 20 identical mysterious robes sewn with ancient arcane symbols. They're for parties. Forcing herself to stay in character, Vale gazed up with wonder and confusion, then shied back against the chasm wall, startling a Kremling with dark purple colorings. A figure at the front spoke first, his voice deep and resonant.
Chanasha Hasare, you have a fine and reputable name, after the legacy of Chanarach Ilin, herald of the common man. Do you truly wish for their return?
Vale raised her hand before the light of the spheres.
What is this? What is happening?
And which one of you is Ialay Sadius?
We are the Sons of Honor, another figure said.
Female this time, but not Ialay.
It is our sworn and sacred duty to usher in the return of the heralds, the return of storms, and the return of our God, the Almighty.
Vale licked her lips.
I don't understand.
You will, the first voice said. We've been watching you, and we find your passion to be worthy. You wish to oust the false king, the Blackthorn, and see the kingdom rightfully returned to the high princes? You wish the judgment of the Almighty to fall upon the wicked?
Of course, Vale said.
Excellent, the woman said. Our faith in you is well placed.
Vale was pretty sure that was Ulina, a member of Ile's inner circle. She'd initially been an unimportant, light-eyed scribe, but was rapidly climbing the social ladder in the new power dynamic of the war camps. Unfortunately, if Ulina was here, Ile probably was not. The High Princess often sent Ulina to do things she did not wish to do herself. That indicated Vale had failed in at least one of her goals. She hadn't made Chanasha seem important enough to deserve special attention.
We guided the return of the Radiance, the man said. Have you wondered why they appeared? Why all of this? The Everstorm? The Awakening of the Parchment? Is happening? We orchestrated it. We are the grand architects of the future of Roshar.
Pattern would have enjoyed that lie. Vale found it wanting. A good lie, the delicious kind, hinted at hidden grandeur or further secrets.
This was instead the lie of a drunken has-been at the bar, trying to drum up enough pity to get a free drink. It was more pathetic than interesting. Moraes had explained about this group and their efforts to bring back the heralds, who had actually never been gone. Gavilar had led them along, used their resources and their hearts to further his own goals. During that time, they'd briefly been important movers in the world. Much of that glory had faded when the old king had fallen, and Amaram had squandered the rest of it. These scattered remnants weren't architects of the future. They were a loose end, and even Radiant agreed that this task, given them by both Dalinar and secretly Moraes, was worthy. It was time to end the Sons of Honor once and for all. Vale looked up at the cultists, walking a careful line between appearing cautious and fawning.
The Radiance. You're Radiant?
We are something greater, the man said. But before we say more, you must be initiated.
I welcome any chance to serve, Vale said. But this is quite sudden. How can I be sure you're not agents of the false king seeking to trap people like me?
All will be made clear in time, the woman said.
And if I insist on proof? Vale said.
The figures glanced at one another. Vale got the feeling they hadn't encountered much resistance during their previous recruitments.
We serve the rightful queen of Alethkar, the woman finally said. Ile? Vale breathed. Is she here?
Initiation first, the man said, gesturing to two others.
They approached Vale, including a tall one whose robes came down only to mid-calf. He was notably rough as he grabbed her by the arms and hauled her upward, then repositioned her on her knees.
Remember that one, she thought, as the other figure removed a glowing device from a black sack. The fabrial was set with two bright garnets and had a series of intricate wire loops.
Shallan was particularly proud of that design, and although Vale had initially found it showy, she now recognized that was good for this group. They seemed to trust it implicitly as they held it up to her and pressed some buttons. The garnets went dark, and the figure proclaimed,
"She bears no illusions."
Selling them that device had been delicious fun. Wearing the guise of a mystic, Vale had used the device to expose one of her light weavers in a carefully planned scheme. Afterward, Vale had charged them double what Shallan had wanted, and the extravagant price had seemed only to make the Sons believe in its power more. Almighty bless them.
Your initiation, the man said. Swear to seek to restore the heralds, the church, and the Almighty.
I swear it, Vale said.
Swear to serve the Sons of Honor and uphold their sacred work.
I swear it.
Swear to the true queen of Alethkar, Ile Sadeas.
I swear it.
Swear you do not serve the false Spren, who bow before Dalinar Kolin.
I swear it.
See, the woman said, looking to one of her companions.
If she'd been a Radiant, she couldn't have sworn a false oath.
Oh, you sweet soft breeze, Vale thought. Bless you for being so naive. We're not all bondsmiths or their ilk. The Windrunners or Skybreakers might have had trouble being so glib with a broken promise, but Shallan's order was founded on the idea that all people lied, especially to themselves. She couldn't break an oath to her Spren without consequences, but this group of human debris? She wouldn't think twice about it, though Radiant did express some discontent.
Rise, daughter of honor, the man said. Now we must replace your hood and return you,
But fear not. One of us will soon contact you with further instructions and training.
Wait, Vale said. Queen Iele, I need to see her to prove to myself whom I'm serving.
Perhaps you will earn this privilege, the woman said, sounding smug. Serve us well, and eventually you will receive greater rewards.
Great. Vale braced herself for what that meant. More time in these war camps pretending to be a fussy, light-eyed woman, carefully worming her way up through the ranks. It sounded dreadful. Unfortunately, Dalinar was genuinely concerned about Iele's growing influence. This little cult here might be gaudy and overacted, but it would be unwise to let a martial presence grow unchecked. They couldn't risk another incident like Amaram's betrayal, which had cost thousands of lives. Besides, Moraes considered Iele to be dangerous. That was recommendation enough for Vale to see the woman brought down. So she'd have to keep working on this, and they'd therefore also have to find more ways to sneak Adolin out to spend time with Shallan. The girl wilted if not given proper loving attention. For her sake, Vale tried.